4:15, so I'll get started. Welcome. I see lots of new faces in this session on Weston, and I'm glad to have you here. Let me just briefly introduce myself and Augustine to you, and then we'll get to the theme of the day. My name's Heidi Gaiman. I am currently on faculty at Hartford Seminary teaching theology and ethics. That is the United Church of Christ Seminary, so I am not Lutheran. I grew up Mennonite, but I am no longer that. But I am an active member of a UCC church in the city of Hartford. As I've been going along here each day, I am starting with a short reading from the first paragraph of the first book of the Confessions. And I'll start with that little prayer again today. And again, I'm adjusting the language to be gender neutral. So let us pray. Can any praise be worthy of the Lord's majesty? How magnificent the Lord's strength! How inscrutable the Lord's wisdom! Humanity is one of your creatures, Lord, and our instinct is to praise you. We bear about us the mark of death, the sign of our own sin, to remind us that you thwart the proud. But still, since we are a part of your creation, we wish to praise you. The thought of you stirs us so deeply that we cannot be content unless we praise you, because you made us for yourself, and our hearts find no peace until they rest in you. Amen. Let me just mention that I chose a particular translation of the Confessions for the bookstore, and they wanted me to remind you that it is there. It's a great translation. There are many translations of this text, and this translation is a very vivid one, as those of you who have heard me read from it this week have noticed. And that's how I will proceed. It's not required to read along. If you are reading along, by the way, feel free to bring questions from the books we're focusing on. But what I'm doing is focusing on a theme each day, and also focusing on two of the books, of the first 10 books of the Confessions, which is really the main part of his personal narrative. And these themes stretch throughout the text, and so we will touch on various themes as we go through the two books that continue his life story, but I'll try to focus today on the theme of friendship. The other thing I should probably say is that we really are focusing more on Augustine's perspective on friendship rather than the theme of friendship in general, but I'm going to ask you to think about your own understandings of friendship as well as we talk a little bit about the text. Just an introduction to Augustine. He was born in 354 of the Common Era, so he was living and writing during the 4th and 5th century. He died in 430 CE. There's lots of things you can say about Augustine. He was a saint. He is a doctor of the Roman Catholic Church. He is probably one of the two most important theologians of the first 1500 years of the church, and I would put him in that category along with Thomas Aquinas. And so he was very prominent. As most of you probably know, Luther was an Augustinian monk before he started the Reformation and left the Catholic Church. Augustine was made bishop in 396, the Common Era, and right after that was when he wrote this book, which is a reflection on his life. It's also a philosophical reflection on various questions such as the meaning of evil, the meaning of time, how memory and language work. So it's a very complex text. But we're kind of reading it during this week as a pastoral, a pastoral autobiography. He's trying to draw us into his own life's journey so that we can perhaps find our way to God a little bit easier than he seems to have. So he reveals quite the struggle along the way as he makes his way to Christianity. And if you are interested in coming tomorrow, we'll talk about his final conversion moment that he describes in Book 8 of the Confessions, but he has various conversions along the way as well. One other thing about Augustine, some people call this the first autobiography. Some people also say that Augustine was really the first psychologist. And in many ways, he seems very modern when you read him because he addresses so many contemporary issues in philosophy and theology that came out in the 20th century, yet he's already talking about them in the 4th and 5th century. So you can think of him as one of the first and best psychologists if you want to think of him that way. And what he really is trying to do here, at least in part, is to reveal the inner workings of his own soul and at the same time then describe to us how the human soul works, who it is we are as human creatures, and that is a very a psychological perspective on the human heart. So on to the topic for today, which is friendship. I think that for those of you who were in the class yesterday, the very end of Book 4, we discussed a short story about friendship, and I would like to just touch on that and read bits of it to you, and then we'll move forward from there. In Book 4, I'm just going to read a few things here about his description of his friend who died. And he doesn't name this friend, but this was a very important friend, and I want to just kind of review that, so bear with me for those of you who were here yesterday, and then move forward. So let me just read a few things here. During those years, when I first began to teach in Thagaste, my native town, I had found a very dear friend. We were both the same age, both together in the heyday of youth, and both absorbed in the same interests. You can think, as I read some of these descriptions of his friends, about what you think about your own friends, what makes them your friends. And for Augustine, it's obviously partly similar interests. He says, we have grown up together as boys, gone to school together and played together, yet ours was not the friendship which should be between true friends, either when we were boys or at this later time. For though they cling together, no friends are true friends unless you, my God, bind them fast to one another through that love which is sown in our hearts by the Holy Ghost, who is given to us. So here you see Augustine's understanding of friendship. He had a very fast friend in his youth, but because their friendship wasn't oriented toward God, he considers it not a true friendship. We can debate that a little later if you would like to challenge that perspective. But he goes on, yet there was a sweetness in our friendship, mellowed by the interests we shared. As a boy, he had never held firmly or deeply to the true faith, and I had drawn him away from it to believe in the same superstitious, soul-destroying fallacies which brought my mother to tears over me. Now, as a man, he was my companion in error, and I was utterly lost without him. Yet in a moment, before we had reached the end of the first year of friendship that was sweeter to me than all the joys of life as I lived it then, you took him from this world. So this friend dies, and he's really completely thrown for a loop by this. He apparently had quite the strong attachment to this friend. And let me just read you little bits of his response to this. And we did, again, talk about some, but not all of this yesterday. His conclusion, one of the conclusions is in this sentence, what madness to love a man as something more than human. And here you can see Augustine's passion coming out. He so passionately loved this person, he assumed that he would be available to him forever. So he realizes now, I mean, not even in the moment, but in retrospect, when he assesses what happened here to him, he thought it was madness because he loved this friend more than something human. What folly to grumble at the lot man has to bear. I lived in a fever, convulsed with tears and sighs that allowed me neither rest nor peace of mind. My soul was a burden, bruised and bleeding. It was tired of the man who carried it, but I found no place to set it down to rest. Neither the charm of the countryside nor the sweet scents of a garden could soothe it. I found no peace in song or laughter, none in the company of friends at table or in the pleasures of love, none even in books or poetry. you can see he's trying to draw himself out of this agony and mourning by various things, and nothing, even books or poetry, are working. Everything that was not what my friend had been was dull and distasteful. I had heart only for sighs and tears, for in them alone I found some shred of consolation. So it's interesting to see again how passionate a man is about a friend, and that he's willing to explain how he cried and wept and was in agony over the loss of this friend. But he goes on and says this: "But if one of my friends died, the fable did not die with him. And friendship had other charms to captivate my heart. We could talk and laugh together and exchange small acts of kindness. We could join in the pleasure that books can give. We could be grave or gay together. If we sometimes disagreed, it was without spite, as a man might differ with himself. And the rare occasions of dispute were the very spice to season our usual accord. Each of us had something to learn from the others and something to teach in return. If any were away, we missed them with regret and gladly welcomed them when they came home. Such things as these are heartfelt tokens of affection between friends. They are signs to be read on the face and in the eyes, spoken by the tongue, and displayed in countless acts of kindness. They can kindle a blaze to melt our hearts and weld them into one." So another passionate description, and bear with me one more short reading, and then I'll ask you to reflect a little bit on what you're hearing here. "If the things of this world delight you, praise God for them, but turn your love away from them and give it to their Maker, so that in the things that please you, you may not displease God. If your delight is in souls, love them in God, because they too are frail and stand firm only when they cling to Him. If they do not, they go their own way and are lost. Love them then in Him, and draw as many with you to Him as you can. Tell them God is the one we should love. He made the world and He stays close to it. For when He made the world, He did not go away and leave it. By Him it was created and in Him it exists. Wherever we taste the truth, God is there. He is in our very inmost hearts, but our hearts have strayed from Him." I think that you've gotten quite a range of what friendship is and means to Augustine, and what he thinks it should be. I wonder if you can pick out a particular point that you think Augustine is trying to say about friendship, something that particularly either made sense to you or bothered you in this description that I gave. I mean, where should friendship fit in our lives? How does it relate to our love for God? And maybe do you agree with him when he says things like, if you delight in something in this world, turn away from it and love God instead?
Which is to say, St. Augustine sees the essence of friendship as being centered in God.
Right, I mean...
And I would certainly agree that the deepest friendships are those in which the participants are centered in God. But I don't think that's the only friendship,
yeah.
Any level of friendship.
Why would a superior friendship be centered in God, do you think?
Because my life is centered in God and Jesus. If that's my center, it would be reasonable that a friend who is similarly centered, we would have more in common and it would be a deeper friendship.
Yeah. Any other comments on what you think he's saying?
Very good point.
Sorry?
Very good point.
Yeah, he was a very passionate friend to his friends. It seems a little overwhelming, actually. I wonder if they were backing away.
I was just going to say that it seems to me that in this case he had to grieve the loss of a friendship, but he knows that he won't ever have to grieve the loss of God, his relationship with God.
Right. God is something you can't lose. where he realizes he had put so much at stake, and he says, what folly it was. And at some place he says, I poured out my soul onto this friend like water onto sand. What did I think was going to happen? Did I think he was going to live forever? So he was crushed by that. Yeah.
And the pursuit of lesser things that will become idolatry, will fail, will become sinful or evil, lead to sin. And only by putting the God at the center that you can avoid that.
Yeah.
It's consistent with his understanding.
Right.
And how life works.
I don't know, so it's interesting. I think my friends, I just made a short list of some I feel closest to, and I feel that they actually speak the word of God to me in many ways. And so I found his description really, really difficult. I mean, I'm not clinging to my friends. I probably cling less to my friends than I do to acquaintances. You know, I probably need my friends less in that. You know, I don't need them to do anything for me. They're these close, intimate relationships who help me come closer to God. So I guess I feel a lot less attachment to those that I'm most intimate with than I do with, say, business, collegial relationships where we're a little bit more interdependent and in getting life done. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I think it's kind of disturbing.
So it's disturbing because it seems that he's saying we should bypass our friends and focus on God, and you're suggesting, but friends actually help us get there?
That's been my experience.
Okay, that's a good observation.
Well, in the last sessions, you pointed out that Augustine is very big on asking why,
mm-hmm.
Why God did this. And in this one, I find kind of playing out, and it's easy because I'm the observer of what he experienced. But in this one, it's like, his revelation about the importance of God came because of the death of his friend. And going back to what you were talking about, you know, Augustine is always interested in what was the good in what appeared to be the evil.
Right.
In the case of Augustine, his passionate attachment to the friend was what allowed him to grow and have this realization that a friendship in which God is the center, because he talks earlier about, you know, a friendship that is
in God,
and welded in God is truer, and that's what he, in the walking away from this painful experience, was a lesson.
Yeah, and he definitely, I mean, throughout the text, he reads it all as God's presence somehow revealing the next step to him. And he does read the death of his friend almost as a judgment of God. I didn't read, you know, where he thinks about that, because I find that a little disturbing. But he does, you know, you have to remember that it was a different time. And so if you believed in an all-powerful, all-knowing, unchanging God, everything has to be read as if God intended it for some good purpose. And so the agony of the death of the friend is, in retrospect, reinterpreted as both a judgment of God because he had flung his entire heart and soul into that relationship instead of to God, and as a wake-up to say, this isn't who you were meant to be. This isn't where all your energy should be directed. So, you know, I always encourage people to read, especially the early church fathers with a hermeneutic of goodwill, at not neglecting the hermeneutic of suspicion, but to give them a chance and to think about what their philosophical and theological context was. So it does seem rather harsh, but, and there's, I see lots of hands over here.
I think he's saying that friendship is a gift from God, but not to mistake the gift for the giver, I mean, like a lot of things. But I also like what he says about you can disagree with your friend and learn from each other, but not have spite mixed in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a wonderful gift, to be able to trust somebody enough that you can, you know, disagree maybe or look at things differently and learn from each other, but somehow not have spite enter it.
help.
Yeah, I think that's a powerful part of his description of, you know, just getting rid of the theological for a moment, just his view of what a friend is. And a friend is some, and we can think about our marriages, of course, hopefully, as friendships too, where you learn to disagree kindly, and it's actually even part of the spice of the relationship, he says. So I think that's a great part of his description.
I guess just a couple of thoughts were coming to me. One, it's been said in different terms, but just what I hear when he's warning against, you know, loving your friends too much, for them, is just not to make an idol out of your friend, not to put the friend where God should be, but in fact the friend can act as a conduit to a deeper understanding of God, a relationship with God. And the other thought that was that occurred to me is when he talks about the love binding friends, I can't remember exactly how he phrased it, there's a lot of times where friendship or connection or mutual interests results in sacrificing somebody else or excluding somebody else that we bind over scapegoating.
Right.
And, which is, you know, the power of Satan in Jordan terms. But, so if instead the power of God that's going to bind us together is sacrificial love, that's what I see there is when he talks about God being at the center of relationships, it's sacrificial love, which is inclusive of others and doesn't bind people together through casting out a third party.
Yeah, I think, I mean, he doesn't say a lot about that, but I think that's also a good observation of, you know, true friendship isn't based on, you know, excluding or scapegoating others. It should open itself up to the community at large. And in the back, I saw a hand over.
Well, the idea that only a relationship that was focused on God was true friendship, that seems to polarize us, you know, and that seems to also be a struggle that we still have. You know, that we're looking for people who think like us or have the same core values as us, and it divides us from other people. And it seems like part of what the gospel is calling us to is to people to see all people as God's creation and find, make friendship maybe from those who are not.
Yeah, I think that is one of the difficult moral questions that applies both to friendship and to care for family versus care for the wider world, that doesn't necessarily exclude, if you were focusing friendship or care and love and concern on those closest to you, most similar to you. And again, I think that for Augustine, the answer would be it can, but it doesn't have to. That a true friend will help you live your life as God intended it to be. And hopefully that means being inclusive of all others, whether or not they are your close soulmate or good friend. You know, even if you have very different interests, you can still, again, not make it an exclusive or excluding friendship.
Yeah. Does he distinguish at all between friendship and acquaintanceship?
He doesn't talk about, like, the term acquaintance isn't used in this text. There are certainly many people he has interactions with, which he describes here, that he doesn't describe as friends. But he doesn't specifically address the philosophical difference between an acquaintance and a friend.
It's interesting how we sometimes have serendipitous circumstances. In our study of Acts this morning, it was made clear that all who fear God and do good works are children of God. So it's not necessarily so exclusive. A person can be a friend who is not denominationally connected or what have you. So our view of children of God, I think, has been broadening in recent years from what used to be the case.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. The ability to relate to others that are not necessarily
denominationally
immediately
like us,
part of your obvious community. Yeah.
Did your Bonhoeffer in Life Together asserts that the work of Christ actually makes Christ the mediator in every relationship, whether they know it or not. And so the closer you are to Christ, the closer you are to your neighbor. So if you want to get close to your neighbor, get close to Christ, and vice versa. Maybe read Augustine.
Yeah. I think he may have.
Yeah.
That story about his friend who died was in book 4, and of course the focus for today is books 5 and 6, but I want to move forward into that and hopefully deepen what he has already said about friendship. But I just want to note that Augustine says nothing negative about that friend, except that, you know, he wasn't really a true friend because we both weren't aiming toward love of God. But he doesn't say anything explicitly or more detailed in a negative sense about that friend. The fault was really in that friendship, that Augustine had, again, poured out his soul in the wrong place or with the wrong person and loved him as if he were more than something human. And again, it's an illustration, as he does throughout the text, of the fact that he's grasping for each thing or person or idea that comes along in his life as this is it, this is what's going to give me peace in life. And obviously that friend didn't, because he up and died. So he moves on in his life, and in fact, he suggests that particular experience, the death of the friend, causes him to physically move on, and he moves to away from Carthage, where he was teaching, and on to Milan. And so he seeks for this, he continues to seek for this peace, as he does throughout the text, among other friends that he makes and has, I guess, from childhood. Apparently, lots of these folks traveled around in groups or followed one another to different cities. And so in book 5, he describes his friends who at this point are also followers of the sect of the Manichees, which we talked a little bit about in previous sessions. I don't want to get into the details of their philosophical theory, but for Augustine, they answered, as best as he could find at the time, they answered the primary question he had in his life, which was, what is the source of evil? And the Manichees had this idea of an evil God and a good God, and neither was superior, and so this whole earth, this whole world was a battle between good and evil. And he liked the solution he found. So he has this set of friends who are also followers of the Manichees, and these are friends who are trying to seek the truth as well with him. And the problem in book 5 for Augustine is that these friends don't really help guide him to the truth, because of course they themselves don't know it. They're followers of Manichaeism, which again in retrospect he has rejected, and having such friends keeps him from following God in a more explicit way than this other, than how he has described this other friend as having kept him from that. So he moves then. He's in Milan for a while. Lots of different stuff happens in this chapter. But he also moves to Rome. Wait a minute, I'm sorry. I've got things backward a little bit. He moved from Carthage to Rome, where he has this set of friends who are Manichees. And he continues his teaching, and he slowly becomes disillusioned with the truth he thought he had found about the question of evil. He becomes disillusioned with the Manichees, and he describes the situation, and this may apply to the idea of an acquaintance. Augustine was a Manichee for about 9 years of his life, and he starts having these questions, and he raises these questions among his group of friends. They are very intent on these philosophical questions. This is what they spend their time doing, and everyone keeps saying, well, wait, you know, Faustus is coming. He will have all the answers. He will tell you the truth. And so he awaits the coming of this great Faustus, who is a Manichee, and he hears Faustus talk, and in some sense it's very rewarding for him, because apparently, like Augustine, Faustus was a great rhetorician, and he spoke beautifully, and Augustine was finally, this guy will give me the answers. But he realizes, as he presses particular points, that Faustus doesn't really know the answers either. And he does say, you know, one thing about Faustus that kind of elevates him among others he has met, and that is that Faustus doesn't pretend to know the answers either. Whereas others have, he says, have tried to, you know, act like, well, we know what we're talking about, and here it is, and don't you get it? And he says Faustus at least had the humility to recognize that he couldn't answer the questions that Augustine had. And he found that highly disappointing. And that was the one of the impetuses, I believe, for him to move on again in his life. And so he had been in Carthage, he moved to Rome, he now is disappointed with Faustus, he moves to Milan. And so I'm kind of skimming over book five here, because it's in book six really that he talks about specific friendships. So at the end of book five, he moves to Milan, and he begins to think, look, he had tried in the past to read scripture, and he found it so much less convincing than what he was reading in the philosophers and in the Manichaean texts. He moves to Rome, and he starts to, Milan, and he starts to consider that Christianity might make some sense. And he decides to start listening to the great Bishop Ambrose, who is a great preacher in Milan at the time. And again, this is probably falls in the category of acquaintance because he never really got to spend time with Ambrose. He was too busy. And in fact, there's some sense of regret in the text where he says, I kind of hovered around. It's like he would sneak by and see if Ambrose was busy so he could really press him with all these questions he had. And he also felt like Ambrose wasn't as rhetorically sophisticated as Faustus had been. But he did begin to think, this guy seems to have some answers that might be acceptable to me. And so he finally, and then this falls in the theme of conversion, which we'll talk about more intensely tomorrow. He finally rejects Manichaeism, but he can't make the conversion to Christianity yet because he's still thinking through all this. So he tries to befriend Ambrose. Ambrose is unavailable. And so he whines about that a little bit and then moves on. So in book six, and as with each book, there's so many themes and stories that are covered in this book that I'm not going to discuss. But in this book, it becomes very clear that all of Augustine's soul searching has been done in the company of friends. This is not as obvious in the beginning part of the book, but I think it's still the case because he often, later as he's telling stories in books five and six, he starts mentioning friends and saying, of course, he was my great friend in childhood and followed me here and etc. So he's always doing this soul searching in the context of friends and conversation partners. And that really fits well with the ancient Greek understanding of friendship, which in part was that you cannot really become a good moral human being or a good citizen without good friends. You simply can't develop into a proper moral person without the company of friends. And again, given the constraints of the times, friends were always pretty much of your social class. And those people who had lots of time to sit around and talk and discuss the ideas and to search for truth, those people had time to become great friends and to become moral persons. And so this is what he's aiming at. So in book four, in book six, unlike in book four, Augustine names his friends. And I'm not sure about the significance of that. He never names the friend who has died in book four. But in book six, he names his friends, and not only that, he tells us their stories. So I just put that out there because maybe you're not getting this impression, but many people have the impression that Augustine is a bit of a narcissist because this whole story is about him. I think that's a misjudgment, and part of the reason, there's many reasons I think that, but part of the reason is he tells stories of his friends and talks about not only their role in his life, but their own particular struggles. And again, I would suggest that, the purpose of that is to draw as many of us into this movement towards God as possible. If Augustine's story doesn't ring true to you, if you don't want to follow his path, maybe this discussion of a particular friend will be convincing to you. So let me just read a story of his great friend Alypius for you. And this is in book 6. It's part of sections 7 and 8. And this, again, bear with me, this is going to be a bit of a long reading, just about 3 pages, I guess.
Could I ask one brief question?
Yeah, jump in.
What was Augustine's role as he moved from Carthage to Rome, right, to Milan as authority?
This is another part of his story and his struggle. His parents deliberately educated him as best they could, even though they weren't persons of great means, but apparently he was a very talented rhetorician, and he studied rhetoric and law, and he's moving around to these different cities as a teacher. So people are hiring him or paying him to teach their sons and daughters, or I guess not only their sons, or the students themselves are paying him. So he gets caught up in this this desire to succeed in the worldly sense of becoming a great teacher and a rhetorician, and apparently he's pretty successful at that. So that's what he's doing.
At the time, the emperor's in Milan.
Right, and you'll see about that in this brief story.
And Milan is really the big, that's the center.
It may not be in this story, but I'll get to the emperor in a little while. So he was very high up. He had connections. Okay, so this is Alypius. And again, Augustine's description of himself at this time is of a completely agonized and tortured soul. He so desperately wants to find the truth and feel like he's living the true life, and he knows somehow that he's not. So he describes these tortured conversations he has with his friends. And so here he has his friend Alypius. He was younger than I was and had been a student of mine, both in our own town when I first began to teach and later on at Carthage. He was greatly attached to me because he thought that I was a good and learned man, and I was fond of him because, although he was still young, it was clear that he had much natural disposition to goodness. But he had been caught in the whirl of easy morals at Carthage, with its continual round of futile entertainments, and had lost his heart and his head to the games in the amphitheater. At the time when he was so wrapped up in this wretched sport, I had opened my school as a professor of rhetoric in Carthage. And then he goes on to describe there was some falling out between their parents, and so this Alypius didn't come to him, but he felt like I should be doing something to help him. And so he says, I had forgotten that I might use my influence with him to prevent him from wasting his talents in this thoughtless, impetuous enthusiasm for futile pastimes. But you, O Lord, who hold the reins of all you have created, had not forgotten this man who was one day to be a bishop and administer your sacrament to your children. So you can see he's already telling us Alypius is a good guy. He's going to turn out okay. So he says, you used me to set him on the right path, but so that we might recognize that it was all by your doing, you used me without my knowledge. One day, so again, trying not to act as if, you know, I saved Alypius, he's saying, God gives us our friends. He puts people in our lives when we need them. So one day, as I sat in my usual place with my pupils before me, Alypius came in, and after greeting me politely, sat down and listened attentively to the lesson. It occurred to me that the passage which I happened to be reading could very well be explained by an illustration taken from the games in the arena. It would appeal to the students and make my meaning clearer, and it would also enable me to make a laughingstock of those who were under the spell of this insane sport. You know, my God, that I was not thinking of Alypius, who so badly needed to be cured of this mania, but he took my words to heart, thinking that I had meant the illusion to apply to him alone. Anyone else would have taken this as a good reason to be angry with me, but this conscientious young man saw it as a cause for anger with himself and warmer affection for me. Long ago, you caused these words of yours to be inserted in your book, "The wise are grateful for a remonstrance." I had not meant to rebuke him, but you use us all. Again, you know, this is God working through him. Whether we know it or not, and for a purpose which is known to you, a purpose which is just. You made my heart and my tongue burn like coals to sear his mind, which was so full of promise, and cure it when it was sick of a wasting disease. Those who have no inkling of your mercy may be silent and offer you no word of praise, but from the depths of my heart I make avowal of your mercy. For after he had heard my words, Alypius hastened to drag himself out of the deep pitfall into which, dazzled by the allure of pleasure, he had plunged of his own accord. By a great effort of self-control, he shook himself free of all the dirt of the arena and never went near it again. So I was going to read this whole other section, but time seems a little short. He goes on to tell then the story of this other set of friends with whom he and Alypius became a part. And he says when they... Alypius went to Rome ahead of him and apparently told Augustine the story about what happened in Rome. Alypius goes to Rome, he has a set of friends, and they kind of tease him about shouldn't he be going to the gladiatorial games, he used to like that sort of thing. This is even more exciting and bloodthirsty. And so he says, I'm not going. And they keep apparently taunting him, and he says, okay, you can take me there bodily, but you can't force me to watch that stuff. And so what ends up happening is he goes to the gladiatorial show, he's hiding his face, but in a moment he glimpses up and he becomes sucked in. So apparently, you know, you might think of him as an addictive personality or however you want to psychoanalyze him. So he gets sucked into these games, and here's what Augustine says. When he saw the blood, it was as though he had drunk a deep draught of savage passion. Instead of turning away, he fixed his eyes upon the scene and drank in all its frenzy, unaware of what he was doing. He reveled in the wickedness of the fighting and was drunk with the fascination of bloodshed. He was no longer the man who had come to the arena, but simply one of the crowd which he had joined in a fit companion for the friends who had brought him. So what is he telling us there about friendship?
What should we hang out with?
Yeah, friends aren't necessarily, neutral.
They don't necessarily want the best for you.
Yeah. His friends should have done everything they could to keep him away instead of taunting him into attending. And apparently he had a terrible weakness for that sort of thing, because you can hardly imagine the description as Augustine has it, but this is the story that he tells. And then he does say, in the end, he again, talking in the context of this scene of slaughter and bloodshed, he says, "Yet you stretched out your almighty, ever-merciful hand, O God, and rescued him from this madness. You taught him to trust in you, not in himself." But this was much later, as he says.
How old is he again from beginning to end in this writing?
At this point, I think he's, when he's in Rome, in Milan, he must be in his
40s.
What did you say? 30s,
I think.
I think it would be late. Let me see if there's a little chart here. I just can't keep the dates straight. But I think he's probably... Okay, he goes to Rome in 383. Yeah, so he's just 30. Oh, sorry, Milan. Yeah, he's 30 when he gets to Milan, and he's there for he's kind of back and forth. So he's in Milan till about the late 380s. So why do you ask that question?
Well, he sounds rather youthful still. And I'm just wondering about if we're going to notice any maturation in him as he proceeds through his writing.
Yeah.
Well, he's writing this when he's...
Oh, this is all retrospective. Okay.
Yeah, he wrote it in 397.
So how old was he when he wrote it?
But I think it is interesting that even in retrospect, the way he describes it, he does seem like, he's 30 and he's a successful rhetorician, and yet he's rampaging around the city. I mean, he's not, but his sets of friends are. Yeah. And I'm sure he did his own. I mean, the way he described his particular problem was sex and lust. Right. So I'm not reading those parts at the moment. But I read those yesterday.
That's
you should have been there. No? So yeah, clearly, I mean, they all have their different passions, and they're getting sucked into the life of the city. Yeah, go ahead.
This, it sort of reminds me of, teenagers and peer pressure.
And yeah, absolutely.
Got sucked into it, which comes into the maturity thought as well.
Yeah, and I think, in some ways, peer pressure is something we talk about with respect to a teen and not applying later in life. But for Augustine, friendships define you throughout life. And so, this group of friends doesn't seem very mature, therefore, neither was Augustine. They were doing the same sorts of things, and they were caught up in city life and all the passion and intensity that entailed.
And I guess what I mean as much by peer pressure in the teenage years is the implication that you're getting sucked into doing things that are harmful or...
And you know better than...
Right, yeah. Right. But as you get older, you may be with groups of friends and you they convince you to do something, but generally it's not...
I wonder if it isn't, just talking about the contemporary context, if it isn't simply a lot more subtle than that, so that, as adults, we're not, going around egging neighbors' houses or whatever kids do in their youth. But at the same time, we live in the suburbs, therefore we have a materialistic lifestyle and we don't even reflect on it. Or that sort of thing, more than, getting talked into some kind of evil deed, right? It totally forms our lives and how we understand the good. We think, just like Augustine, if my friends are Manichees, then there must be some truth. And they think about it and talk about it together. And when they finally all decide this isn't working, they kind of leave as a group. I mean, he describes earlier in the book talking a friend into the Manichean sect, and then later talking other friends out of it, or having other friends talk him out of particular perspectives on things. Yeah.
So I think that this is... I'm a college professor. I got to spend this. I taught at Harvard this spring, which was really very interesting.
There's a lot of debauchery going on.
There's a lot of debauchery going on there. And there's this best and brightest kind of thing, you see in the students and the professors, uh-huh. and their thing. And so in Rome, there was a common culture, and the rhetoricians were the people who defined it. And learning how to speak. Well, it's not just speaking well, the sense of speaking persuasively, although that was part of it. It was how you conducted yourself. Very much in public, very much your persona, identified you as a Roman citizen.
Right.
So this is a group of people who were talking about not just these philosophical ideas for people every day. What are the ideas that the elite should share that are called by their very nature to run Rome? And he's moving from Carthage to Rome to Milan to where the emperor is. And so this is the circle of people who are debating what they're doing. I had this conversation with a professor at Harvard who was talking about his students in the Barack Obama campaign and his students in the McCain campaign and his students in the Clinton campaign. These got that.
You mean as very distinctive groups?
Yes, but also as that part of that conversation, right? That these weren't people who were separate. These were people who were part of the same conversation, and at the moment were divided up this way. Next week they'd be maybe divided up another way. Mm-hmm. So this was not a group of teenagers in Milan. These were guys who were thinking about how should we think about these problems? What should we be doing? And so that was an active debate.
I feel great.
Yeah.
And then when I had it from a breaking that glass, too, somebody got hurt.
Don't think it is.
I really heard that about breaking the glass. And swimming, too.
Besides those points, they also had a lot of discretionary time.
Oh, yeah.
As opposed to the masses.
Right.
They represent the nobility, the elite.
Well, we've had a tremendous amount of misbehavior in the nobility, I would say, today. A work of the law, you know, that's this modicum of behavior these are really for society, not for me in particular, because of my political station or economic station or religious station or whatever. So I don't know if they felt they were the elite.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. We're going to debate this. Meanwhile, we're going to go to these bloodthirsty whatever, and, you know, I don't know. But
oh, no, I think there was very much a sense of virtue when we're talking the business about Cicero. There was very much a common sense that these elites should comport themselves in a particular kind of way, part of which was having friends, and part of which was civic virtue and being involved. And, you know, if you had money, you built a bath, or you did, you know, so that you were involved in this virtuous activity. And that was a really, really strong part of how they identified themselves as elites.
They built the society as they thought it should be constructed.
Right.
So they were very powerful.
Yeah.
And so, it, you know, in some sense, you think, you know, he's sitting around thinking about all this stuff. What's that worth? But really, you know, the leaders of the culture were trying to shape it.
Yeah.
And he, you know, Christianity versus these other forms of thinking, you know, just being a good citizen in Rome or being a Manichae, these were different forces that were competing for a lifestyle, I guess I would say.
And remember I said this morning about Ambrose. Ambrose was the bishop that excommunicated the emperor.
Hmm.
That's in Milan. So these are... These are
very
really
powerful people.
Very powerful and very weighty, important discussions that they.
Well, okay, go ahead. Let me get you two right.
Just to go back to the moral of that last story you read, I was reminded of a book by Robert Ellsberg, the All Saints book that he wrote, where he profiles 365 saints, maybe recognized or not recognized saints in this book. And in his introduction, he notes that what he was struck by in doing all this research and looking into it was that every single one of them had were connected to each other in some way, or connected to another saint of some sort, or, you know, another, they were friends with somebody, had mentors. And so, it just points back towards what Augustine's talking about there, that our friendships can pull us. Right.
Yeah, they can pull us up or pull us down.
Right.
Just speaking quickly in defense of peer pressure and peer groups, you know, you look at kids, people my age, people other people's ages, and you get together with a group of people. I don't think any group says, let's get them over and do something evil, like let's go do something bad. Like, it all depends on your frame of reference, and, you know, these people who went to the track, to them it wasn't something bad to do. And I think what you're saying is Augustine is really looking for what matters, what's important. And some, I mean, there's a lot of trial and error in that. And,
right.
You know.
Some are hard too.
You bounce around and just, I think from Augustine's perspective, what he had kind of discerning as what matters, what happens at the track doesn't matter. And in fact, kind of works against what matters to him. But, I mean, just kind of in defense of peer pressure and peer groups.
No, I think.
There are peer groups that do intend to do evil.
Yeah, peer pressure is good.
Yeah, I guess I would say that, you know, that, and Augustine describes an early incident in his life where he says, you know, we all got together and did this evil act. For what? For nothing. But I think we're not dissing peer pressure. We're saying, and Augustine is saying too, here we're seeking the truth. My friends and I are seeking the truth. We're seeking here, we're seeking there, we're doing it together. And that's right. You can't find your way alone. And I think he would agree with that you need the conversation partners, or you're not, you know, and of course, that doesn't say that he doesn't also have a very strong sense of the inner life and the personal aspect of finding God, but, you know, that's constructed in the group as well. I'd just like to, did you want to jump in, sir? No? Okay, thought you looked like you were about to say something. I want to read a little bit more here. He goes on, poor Alypius, you know, he's given this horrible description in this book, but he does go on to explain how he then becomes an assistant to a judge and what a morally upright character he becomes. And he also says that here, Alypius and Nebridius are his real partners at this point in his life. And he says this: we were like three hungry mouths, able only to gasp out our needs to one another, while our eyes were on you, waiting for you to grant us in due time our nourishment. And in all the bitter disappointments which by your mercy thwarted our undertakings in this world, in other words, their worldly success was thwarted partly because of their conversations of saying this isn't it, we tried to see the reason for our sufferings, but darkness overshadowed us, and we turned away asking, how long is this to be? Again and again we asked ourselves this question, but we did not relinquish our worldly aims because we could not see the light of any truth that we might grasp in place of them. So again, they're talking about how what they have, the acclaim and the material wealth that they have, is not where it's at, yet there's nowhere else for them to go. They can't find an alternative. And they even, at one point in this chapter, along with about seven or eight other people, contemplate living in a community that's apart from society, kind of removed from the city life, pooling their resources and spending their time in peace, you know, having a few of them run the ship while the others have time to live the life of leisure, not in the sense of, you know, leisure in our context, but life of reflection and contemplation. And at this point in his journey, Augustine doesn't think he has reached the point of loving his friends in God. Again, in retrospect, even though they're deeply committed to one another, he doesn't think he's loving them in God. But he does say, and this may, you know, answer the question of how, you know, it kind of bothers some of us that you can't love the friend, you have to love God, and somehow, you know, are you going around the friend, or what is the meaning of real friendships then? He does say, I certainly loved them for their own sakes, and I felt that they loved me for my sake in return. So he's not negating the friendship as getting in the way anymore at this point, but he's saying we certainly aren't there yet, we haven't found God. But in retrospect, he claims that they can't succeed most fully in loving each other. You know, they can't succeed in loving each other completely for their own sake because they haven't found God. So again, we talked yesterday about disordered love and rightly ordered love, and while he's not negating the love he has for his friends, he's saying there can be a more ideal love. And this brings, I mentioned in the, I don't know if you came in part because of my description, but I also say something about Augustine's friendship with God. And wow, we have 3 minutes to describe that. but I guess I'll just say one basic thing, and that is, I think that Augustine's friendship with God, and he doesn't, you know, he's not talking about friendship with God here in particular, but his friendship is with God is really represented in the entire way that the text is formed. It's a dialogical text. It's a conversation between Augustine and God, really. Among and many other things, that's what it is. It's a prayer to God. It's a text that's meant to praise God. And he's conversing with God as he does with his friends. He's asking questions. Why, oh God, did you let me go down this path? Or is this the meaning of true love? Or should I get married? And why is this taking so long? Or why did you have my mother baptize me as an infant and I wouldn't have gone down this terrible path? So he's talking to God. He's asking questions. He's praising God. He's petitioning for grace, just as he does with his friends. You know, the description of these intense conversations he has with his friends is what he's now doing in this whole book as a conversation with God. And I think he sees them in very similar ways.
To be able to disagree but without spite, is that part of the friendship with God?
I suppose it must be. Although I probably have to say that Augustine wouldn't have said that.
Yeah.
Augustine probably wouldn't have said you can easily disagree with God and that's part of the friendship.
Yeah, yeah.
How many times he would do a thing, God would just pray for me, and that's why I would think of it, but if I turn around it and then he faced me, when he turns around, but he's in my heart and everything he wants to get into. Mm-hmm. But he lets it get into me, and I have to pray for them as well until I do. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm thinking now.
I think Augustine would say very many, sorry. Yeah, I think Augustine would say very similar things. He has this concept of, I kept turning away from God. And I, in fact, it was a turning away from myself. And if I had only looked within, and this is where it gets a little bit more of the, you know, inner-directed personal spirituality. If I had turned within, I would find God there.
For thinking about anyone, two kind of people coming back.
Yeah. Well, I invite you to think about your own lives. I didn't give you very much time to share about your own personal experience. Friendship.
I tell you that more. I'm telling you, I care more than your own.
But I invite you to do that and think about your relationship with God in terms of friendship as well. And thank you for coming.
Thank you.